We have so much time, I feel like I don't have to rush. But it's a long chapter, so we're gonna get into it. But it's a lot of narrative. Chapter 27, I did put up the map. This one does require a map. As we read it, you'll find that there's a lot of movement there. This is Paul's voyage to Rome. So basically, what you see here in the map today in chapter 27, they go this direction, they hit the storm over here, spent about 14 days lost, or not lost, but carried by the wind, and end up at Malta, and that would be chapter 28. The last chapter deals with that. But today we'll look at that first part. So the last two chapters basically deals with Paul going to Rome. Right? In Acts chapter 19, verse 21, Paul said he wanted to go to Rome. That was his desire, and obviously God had prepared him for that as well. Then in Acts 23:11, the Lord said, appear to him and said, have courage, for as you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. And then in Acts 21:8, we find that Luke is with Paul but stays there. Verse 8 says, the next day we left for Caesarea, where we enter. So we'll find out that Luke actually joins them. That was the last time we see him, in Acts 21:8. Now this is the last time you'll see him join the team, join Paul in this journey. Now going to Rome, I've been watching a series on my TV or on Amazon Prime about Rome. It was very interesting. How it started, and I was very interested because I wanted to find out more about Mr. Nero. What was he like? Gosh, all the way from those emperors, starting from Caligula, and after Caligula came Claudius, and after Claudius came Nero. I mean, all those guys. Claudius was an okay emperor, and he wasn't as bad as the other ones. He actually did a lot more good, but there was all kinds of crime, and all of them got killed, by the way, got betrayed by somebody, and politically that got tossed out. Claudius, before Nero, married his cousin Agrippina, and they had a son, and his name was Nero. But prior to that, Claudius, previous emperor Caligula, had killed his siblings. So he spared, for some reason, he spared Claudius. And Claudius was pretty much deformed. They made fun of him when he was growing up. And at Caligula's death, he had no one else. He had no heir to the throne. And so it just fell on Claudius. And Claudius was actually a better emperor. And he actually did a lot to improve things in Rome. But his wife Agrippina was not very good. He actually he had his son Nero. He wanted Nero to eventually become emperor. And he actually brought a philosopher, Seneca, to teach him all about good philosophy, morals. And he spent a lot of time teaching Nero. But eventually this woman wanted to kill, made plots to kill Claudius. And Claudius was pretty reluctant at first to do anything. But eventually he got convinced, had to kill his wife, had to send people to kill his wife. Well, it was at sea, and it failed, so she swam to shore, and she went somewhere else, or hid somewhere else. And then so Claudius actually sent up a cohort to kill her while she was in bed. So she got killed. But then Claudius got poisoned, got killed. But people didn't like him as well. And then he had Nero assume the emperorship. But he was very young. Remember I told you he was very young? He was already 13. He wasn't ready to assume that role. At a very young age, assumed the role of emperorship. Started okay, ended up being crazy at the end. So when Paul has become prisoner, he is not as bad. He's a young guy, but he's not... He's kind of rule by what Seneca told him. But as soon as he gets the power, right, he feels that he's in control, then he starts doing bad things. And one of the things, for example, that he did, he used to go out in the streets and just kill people for no reason. And that's how evil he became. He was just crazy. And people disliked that because he was doing that. And apparently after a while, when Paul becomes a prisoner, Paul's not going to meet him here. But after chapter 28, we know from history, we don't know exactly, I mean, this is what we can tell, that he actually met, right, the emperor. And the Lord promised he would meet this young guy and share the gospel. Now, he didn't become a believer, obviously, because after he went crazy and wanted to deflect all this stuff that he was doing that was wrong, he decided that this fire started in Rome. It's called the Great Fire. Some think that he actually started it. And so what he did is try to find a scapegoat. Who can he blame for this fire? Can you guess? Christians. So he blamed the Christians. And so he went after all the Christians. And he actually brought him in and he made a spectacle of them. Brought them to as torchlights. He lit them up on fire, right, during this time. So he pretty much killed many Christians. And during that time, Paul was still in jail. And Paul is actually killed under Nero at this time. Now what happens to Nero? Well, he gets assassinated as well. He gets, the Senate doesn't like him because he's done all these bad things. Eventually, he's also killed himself. And somebody else assumes the role. But where in Acts, we end up with this emperor. So where is he heading? He's heading to Rome. He's going to meet Nero. Okay, little short history. It's really a fascinating thing. You got to look at it. And I'm interested in the parallels because people say, oh, the way Rome fell, it follows the parallels of many countries of fall, how internally they break down from their morals and collapse in power and become nothing. So people say, oh, the United States heading in that direction. It is like Rome. I mean, it may be powerful from the outside, but because of all the internal things, it falls apart. Now,
what was the name of the...
It's just called Rome.
It'll
be, it's just, and it has different, it starts with Rome and it moves on to different powerful nations and other, but I'm just going through that. So it's really interesting. Anyway, so let's look at chapter 27 and 28. Now we know from chapter 27 and 28 that Luke is joining him and Aristarchus is also becomes very helpful to Paul. Now, some people have asked, why is this so long? Why does Luke take two chapters to explain a narration about sea travels to get to Rome? People think this is not even possible that Luke actually wrote it because it's just too long. But Luke is following the pattern of Greek writers, which included sea travels. One especially significant story about sea travel is the Odyssey. And I've never personally read the thing, but you know, I know the story of it, right? And usually people travel on the sea. When they travel the sea, there are the gods of the sea. And so there are all kinds of things happening in the sea because the gods of the sea are there, are either to punish you or to help you. And so Luke kind of follows that idea of taking Paul in the sea travel, but showing God's sovereignty. And you'll see it, how incredible he takes this to show people that, hey, this is our God that we serve. The other thing why it's really long is because I think Luke joins him, and it makes it more credible. If you have Luke in the process, you know that actually Luke took part of it. You would actually say about the book of Acts, hey, he is a credible writer because he actually took part of this. But I think more importantly, Luke shows in these two chapters remaining in the book of Acts that God is sovereign. And I know you've heard me say a lot of it, but I just keep seeing it. God is sovereign over everything. And Paul will arrive to Rome in spite of the circumstances he faces. Let's look at the first part. Paul and his companions start the journey to Rome, verses 1 through 8. All right, so let's read. When it was decided that we were to sail, notice we, Luke, to sail to Italy, they handed over Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Imperial Regiment. So when we had boarded a ship of Adramyttium, I think, we put to sea intending to sail to ports along the coast of Asia. Here's where the map is going to be significant. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we put on at Sidon. So you see here in the map, Here they are. They're in Caesarea. So we put up. They went to Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly, allowed him to go to the friends to receive their care. When we had put out to sea from there, we sailed along the northern coast of Cyprus. So this part here, right? Because the winds were against us. After sailing through the open sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we reached Myra in Lycia. So here's Myra. So they go this way around Cyprus, that's the island, and then come to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. Sailing slowly for many days, we came with difficulty as far as Cnidus. There's Cnidus. Since the wind did not allow us to approach it, we sailed along the south side of Crete of Salmon. This way. With yet more difficulty, we sailed along the coast and came to a place called Fert Havens near the city of Lazia. Right there. So that's the first eight verses. That's kind of the start of the journey. Now, Paul was an experienced sea traveler. According to 2 Corinthians 11:25, he actually been three times shipwrecked. We only have one account right now in this passage. So we know Paul traveled by sea a lot. So he was experienced. He wasn't an amateur, so he knew what it was like. It is estimated that he traveled about 3,000 miles by sea. Okay, so the first part, we looked at verses 1 through 3. They go from Caesarea to Sidon, right? That's the first part, Caesarea to Sidon. And then, that's about 80 miles. And had Luke and Aristarchus with him. Now, why are they sailing in ships like this, where there are prisoners, other prisoners? And this is a smaller ship. Back then, they didn't have personal ships. So you couldn't take, oh, I'm going to take my personal ship to go travel. You had to go with cargo. You had to go with commercial ships. So they're actually on a smaller boat right now, verses 1 through 3. And they're about 80 miles. But then they get, verse 3 says that they get to Sidon. And notice that he says that he's get cared for, or Paul gets cared for in Sidon. And Julius is very gracious and kind, allows him to receive care. We don't know who those are, those believers. Maybe non-believers, who knows? Maybe people that Paul knows. But what we know is Julius actually treats him kindly and allows him to go and get some care. What kind of care? Well, help either for food, because they need to take food along the journey. They don't just provide you food. They don't provide you a place either on the ships where you can just relax. You actually go on the deck on the second part of the ship, and you actually take your own things. You cook there. They let you cook. Some of them can go up and maybe do some cooking. But basically, you're in the bottom of the ship where there's room. That's how you travel. This is not a private travel. So Paul needs care, whether it is physical care, where maybe he needed some resources to carry along, but he gets taken care of. And this is very important, even as just a little phrase there, believers taking care of Paul. I think they were believers, so I just being able to be taken care for, and Paul also getting that care. There are a lot of believers that don't want to be cared by anyone else. I think it's important sometimes we need to be cared by other people because we can't do everything by ourselves. Okay, and then from Sidon, they go to Myra in Lycia, verses 4 and 5. Now, here in Myra, right, they're going to get another ship. Let's see verse 5. Found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. This is a bigger ship. So he's going to join a bigger ship that is carrying, actually, some believe, and most from the text you'll see it as well, grain. So they carry a lot of stuff from Alexandria in Egypt, and they're carrying it all the way to Rome. So they do a lot of import, export, right? So they're taking this big ship. They're joining this ship because it's bigger, and it's heading towards Italy. So they join that ship right there. And Paul is going to go on that. And verses 6 through 8, we find that they actually go to Fair Haven. And there are about 276 people in that ship, and they sail pretty slowly, right? For 130 miles from Lycia, from Myra all the way to this place here. That's about 130 miles. Okay, so it's a lot of sea travel. All right, let's look at the second part, verses 9 through 12. Paul's counsel rejected. So they get to Fair Havens here, Crete. This is what happened, verse 9. By now, much time had passed. the voyage was already dangerous. Since the fast was already over, the fast was actually a Day of Atonement, so a Jewish fast, right? And after that fast was over, they offer thanksgiving to God and so on. Fast was already over. Paul gave his advice and told them, "Men, I can see that this voyage is headed toward damage and heavy loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid attention to the captain and the owner of the ship rather than to what Paul said. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided to set sail from there, hoping somehow to reach Phoenix, a harbor on Crete, open to the southwest and northwest and to the winter there. So Paul's counsel is here rejected, right? I believe this is some sort of prophetic warning that Paul is seeing, but not only is he skilled as a sea traveler, but I think, you know, he's a man of God. He knows, and he's warning them. This is not heading in the right direction. But do they listen to him? No, right? They don't listen to him. Julius, actually, the Roman centurion, actually doesn't listen. He listens to the captain and the owner of the ship. What would happen if people listen to wise counsel, huh? I sometimes wonder, even as believers, do you tell believers things like, you know, this is not a good, I don't foresee this being something good. And a lot of times, they're like, oh, whatever. Right? I've seen it happen. I don't know about you. Giving counsel to people when they are having, they're doing something you know is not probably heading a good direction. And you let them know, and they just kind of go, whatever. And then you see the consequences. You go, you want to say I told you so. Right? But you kind of go, I know you want to, but you know, you kind of, yeah, I know you and I will probably say it. You know, let me tell you in one area that I've seen it happen more often, and it's in relationships, especially, and not all of us are married here. We don't have this problem right now, but there are young people who are getting married, and a lot of them are looking for a partner. And we were talking about this with someone yesterday, I think. Oh, with Chuck. And it's important to have a right partner in your life. It's hard enough to be believers, right? And you're struggling in your marriage. It's harder if the person is not a believer. And I have told so many people, hey, be careful who you choose. Make sure it's a believer. And it almost goes out like they don't care, right? It's not like being a believer is the same as anything. And I've warned people, hey, you know what? This is not a relationship. And when they are into this mode, I want this person. I want to conquer this person. They conquer that person. And then when they're married, right, they end up failing. And we know at least one couple that we actually married, and they weren't believers, how they got involved. Now they're separated after, you know, 20 or so years. And there are people that we led to Christ. But, again, they don't listen. Sometimes it's very frustrating when there's wise counsel given to people and they don't listen. Now, and Paul is telling them here, this is what's going to happen. Listen, do they listen? Nope. But they have Paul. At least that Paul is going to save them. Let's verses 11 and 12. The centurion does not listen, so it's rejected. Now let's look at verses 13 through 38. Paul's life-saving encouragement. Notice the switch that happens. Here is the centurion taking control, right? Oh, and the captain of the ship and the owner of the ship, two different people. But from here on, you'll see who's leading this. It's Paul assuming the role of pastor, whatever you want to call it, missionary, apostle. He takes his role as a spiritual leader, which is awesome, right? That it will be said of many of us. Verse 13 and on. When a gentle south wind sprang up, they thought they had achieved their purpose. They weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. I have to tell you, I have never sailed. So some of this stuff, even after reading information about it, I'm like, I don't know what this means. So be my guest, study it. There are people who are sailors who actually study this as how accurate was Luke. And they said, it's right on. Of what people would do on a ship and the kind of in the situation that they were in. I have no idea, so I'm just going to read it and kind of go through it. So they are the shore of Crete, right here. But long afterward, a fierce wind called a northeaster, which when I was reading about this, it's actually that's what they call it. And everybody does not want that to happen. Rushed down from the island. Since the ship was caught up and was unable to head into the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. After running under the shelter of a little island called Kuda, I don't know, we were barely able to get control of the skiff. So barely control the ship, right? So they're around here. I don't know where the other island, I think, is somewhere here. After hoisting it up, they use ropes and tackle and girded the ship. So what they're trying to do is trying to hold the ship together. Some say it's like wrapping it from the bottom or tying it from the bottom around. Why? Because they're going against the wind. And what happens with all the cargo in the wind? This I understood. Right? What happens? If you're going head on against the wind and you have all this cargo and it's heavy, what's going to happen to the ship? It's going to break it. It's going to break it. The wind is head on and it's got power. So with all this thing, it's going to go head on and it's going to break. So they're trying to hold it together so that they can go with the wind, but they're not going to do it. Okay? Barely control the ship. And then says, after hoisting it up, they used ropes and tackle and girded the ship. Then fearing they would run aground onto Syrtis, they lowered the drift anchor, and in this way they were driven along. Because we were being severely battered by the storm, they began to jettison the cargo the next day. Again, why? They've got to make it lighter. The heavier the ship, the greater the impact. So they're trying to take some cargo out. On the third day, they threw the ship's gear overboard with their own hands. So they're throwing gear also because it's going to make the ship lighter. For many days, neither sun nor stars appear, and the severe storm kept raging. Why is that important? Because when, remember, this time of history, they didn't have those ships that were powered by, you know, whatever source we use. What was it? Fire? Anyways, they were using the wind to drive them. And the wind is blowing against them, so they're not moving. The other thing is, how do they set directions to move? Of course, it's through the stars, through the sun. But it's black, so they can't see where they're going. There was all darkness. Since many were going without food, verse 20, for many days neither sun nor stars appeared, and severe storm kept raging. Finally, all hope that we would be saved. No, we, Luke is thinking this way too. We would be saved was disappearing. Since many were going without food, Paul stood up among them and said, okay, let's stop there because I want to spend a little more time. But what happened? Well, they're going right. And they know they're losing all hope to actually get to where they're going. And people are pretty much, their hope is disappearing. They say even including Luke, except Paul. Paul's the only guy who knows, I know where we're going. That's pretty amazing, right? You got 270 plus men, almost 300. They're all like, oh, this is it. We're going to die. Even Luke, we're going to die. Because they have no, everything is lost. They have no hope of getting anything. So this probably happens on, again, she's on the bottom. People are sitting down. Some of the people, it can't be everyone because some of the others are trying to control the ship above the deck. Paul stands up in verse 21. You men should have followed my advice not to sail from Crete and sustain this damage and loss. So there's Paul nicely saying it. You guys should have listened to me in the first place. Right? Now I urge you to take courage, because there will be no loss of any of your life, but only the ship. Again, if it was just Paul speaking, you would have said, you're crazy. But look what he says in verse 23. For this night, an angel of the God I belong to and serve stood by me and said, don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. This is the first time God actually tells him specifically, you're going to speak to Caesar. So that's what we know. And we can affirm that Paul actually did speak to Nero. And look, God has graciously, I love this sentence, God has graciously given to you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, take courage, man, because I believe God that it will be just the way it was told to me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. So we must go to ground. When the 14th night came, we were drifting in the Adriatic Sea. And in the middle of the night, the sailors thought they were approaching land. So they're here. They're hitting this storm. They took a sounding and found it to be 120 feet deep. When they had sailed a little further and sounding again, they found it to be 90 feet deep. Then, fearing we might run aground in some rocky place, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight to come. Some sailors tried to escape from the ship. Why? I mean, they think the ship is going to break up. And like, we're out of here. We don't want to be part. One of their fears was sailors were very mystic. I don't know, for a better, lack of a better word. In other words, yeah, superstitious. So if they did not want to die in the sea, they believed if you died in the sea, the gods were not, you weren't going to rest in your death. You would wander, your spirit would wander forever. So if you die at sea, so they don't want to die in sea. They want to get out of there. And if you're going to die, I want to die on land, right? And so they were ready to jump to do that, pretending they were going to put anchors from the bow. Paul said to the centurions and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Why? They need the sailors. They can't, I mean, how are they going to sail? They can't do it. Then the soldiers cut the ropes holding the skiff and let it drop away. When it was about daylight, Paul urged them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day. Notice that you have been waiting and going without food, having eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for this has to do with your survival, since none of you will lose a hair from your head. So let's go back a little bit. Right? Danger, loss of all hope. Paul stands up, gives prophetic encouragement. Let's look at this prophetic, what I call prophetic encouragement. It's based on several things. Look at verse 23. Go back to that. Number one, it's based on God's relationship, on Paul's relationship with God. Notice what he says? The God I belong and serve. I love that. Paul belongs to God, serves him. He's sovereign over his life. And through an angel, he tells him, you're going to be standing before Caesar. And that's why Paul can say, you'll be okay. Why? Because I have a relationship with God. He's taking care of me. Number two, he says, God has graciously given you all those who are sailing with you. It's based on God's grace. God didn't have to save anyone except Paul. Could have killed all those people and left Paul alive. But isn't that God just graciously gave Paul everyone else? So these men, if they had gone by themselves, they would have died. Because Paul wasn't there. Now, I'm assuming, thinking that Paul probably prayed and asked for them, for their safety as well. But it's based on God's grace. Now, what is this story? Does this your story remind you of anyone in particular in the Old Testament? It reminded me of someone. Kind of the opposite side of this. Here is Paul, a man of God who's saving all these men. But he's an obedient man who follows God. Does it remind you of anyone? Who's
in the ship?
Yes. Yeah. The Old Testament. Yes. Jonah. Remember Jonah? He was the cause of the ship's problem. And they literally had to say, oh, I know why you're having problems. Throw me out in the ocean because it's me that's causing you the problem. If you don't throw me out, I'll die. You'll die. Right? And here is the opposite. Paul is, without Paul, they can't be saved. Because God is in control of Paul's life. But it reminded me of that and how different it is for a man who is obedient. So it's based on God's grace, but also verse 25, he says, therefore take courage, man, because I believe that it will be just the way it was told to me. He believes God's faithfulness, right? He believes God has said something and he will do it. I don't know about you, but it's still hard for me. Sometimes God says something like, really? I don't know, God. Right? Am I the only one? John, do you ever have those doubts?
I'm right with you.
I'm like, trust me. I don't know, God. I don't think.
Maybe that wasn't God's voice.
Yeah. I don't know, right? I don't think that's God.
What's bad is you give advice to people and it's the same advice that you need.
Absolutely. I thought that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I should be listening to myself, right? Absolutely. You always think about it. And Paul, there is unwavering faithfulness. That's what is so impressive, right? He unwavers in his faithfulness. It's just like, no, I know. God will do. He said he will do it. He will do it. Now, this is in the midst of, again, if you look at the Roman Empire, it was horrible. It was so decadent. Rome was pretty decadent. If you think our times are bad, I don't think they're any different. I mean, often I go, oh man, this is horrible. It gets worse and worse. But when you look at history, it's almost the same. And I was reading the book of Acts again because that's where my reading goes. And remember when Peter told them, repent and be baptized? The next verse he says, and with many other words he told them to to be away, to flee from the wicked generation. So even Peter at that time was saying, this generation is wicked, is evil. Now, are we to say that it's any better? No. Right. And Rome was pretty decadent. I mean, you study Rome, you'll see that they were actually pretty bad.
They are.
And the emperors were, if you think, oh, we got bad people, politicians, they were worse. There was assassination happening for every person that came to power. They lasted 40 years or whatever, and then got tired, kill him, get next one. You know, it's like, it's very decadent. Anyway, so it's based on God's faithfulness. So that's very important, right? This encouragement is based on Paul's relationship with God, based on his grace, based on God's faithfulness. Paul believes that God will do that. Now, in verses 27 and 38, we find the ministry of encouragement from Paul. I love this about Paul, right? And we read it after the 14th day. So they have spent 475 miles adrift in the ocean. 14 days. 475 miles. Lost in the ocean with no hope. But Paul encourages them to eat, assures them that nothing, not even a hair. Now, that's an expression saying nothing will happen to you. Relax. You'll be okay. And then Paul takes the lead. So Paul is leading now. You notice that? The change? Verse 31 says, eat, right? They haven't eaten probably because they're just working hard at trying to save the ship. But here Paul says, it's enough. You are hungry. When you're hungry, what happens? You are weak. And when you're weak, you start questioning your own survival. So Paul says, you need to eat. Paul taking care, encouraging them. And then, in verse 33, it says, 34, therefore you should take some food, for this has to do with your survival, since none of you will lose a hair from your head. After he said these things and had taken some bread, he gave thanks to God in the presence of all of them, and when he broke it, he began to eat. They all became encouraged and took food themselves. In all, there were 276 of us on the ship. When they had eaten enough, they began lightening the ship by throwing the grain overboard into the sea. So again, it's a commercial ship. So Paul encourages them, right? By he eats, he gives thanks. He's assuming to hear the pastor with sailors, not believers, right? Praise, may all eat, get encouraged. Verses 39 through 44, we have how Paul's life is saved by the centurion, which is also God's sovereignty at work. Let's read it. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land by sight of a bay with a beach. They planned to run the ship ashore if they could. After casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, at the same time loosening their ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted foresail to the wind and headed for the beach. But they struck a sandbar and ran the ship aground. The bow jammed fast and remained immovable while the stern began to break up by pounding of the waves. So here it is, shipwreck. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that no one could swim away and escape. But the centurion kept them from carrying out their plan, because he wanted to save Paul. So he ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to follow, some on planks and some on debris from the ship. And this way, everyone safely reached shore. So here Paul's life is saved by a centurion, because the ship pretty much is wrecked, right? It broke. Even with all their attempts to save it, breaks apart. And so what do the soldiers decide we're going to have to do? Why? Why would they do that?
Well, if they lose their prisoners, they die.
Yeah, it was very serious, right?
Except that Paul was a Roman citizen, and the centurion knew that.
Yes.
He wasn't about to kill a Roman citizen.
Well, right, he says here, why? Why did centurion? He liked Paul. Remember, he let Paul get some help from believers.
True.
So he liked Paul. But it's a sovereign act of God, right? More than anything, it's God protecting Paul.
Mm-hmm.
This soldier was ready to kill all the prisoners. Now, some of these prisoners were convicted. We don't know exactly, but we assume that a lot of them are convicted criminals going to Rome, either to be put to death. Some of them perhaps were taken there to offer entertainment for Nero after they have become prisoners, right? Treating them like slaves. But what we find interesting that the centurion actually saves Paul by telling people, no, just go down, swim to the shore, and then we'll catch up to you. And they do, and they're actually saved. So again, God's sovereignty at work here, right? Paul is saved, but this man, and they actually reach the shore safely. So what do we learn from all this? Well, I think I've already mentioned some of this. Is first is God's sovereignty, right, at work. He's at work in Paul's life. And he will fulfill that, his purpose in his life, just as he will in our lives. Fulfill a purpose in our lives. When is our time to go? We will go. When God says it's time, it's time. And for his church as well. We are losing hope nowadays, right? The church is like, wow, what do we do? No lights, no directions, where do we go? But we shouldn't be doing that, right? We should trust in God and God's faithfulness that he will accomplish his plan with his church. No matter what the circumstances are, he will be with us. And did you see when Paul is talking to this man, have any of them come to Christ yet? Have they believed? You read chapter 28. I don't think maybe any of them, I don't know. I'm assuming that maybe some could have come to Christ, but not many. But was Paul still witnessing to them? Giving testimony, his faith in the Lord? He was. To him, he didn't.
I think the centurion was really aware of it because, I mean, he did things so openly, like we should do. You know, he gave thanks to God openly.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of life. It was a way of life for him, but yet it's a witness to.
And I'm sure he had seen Paul. Paul's life.
Yeah.
And he liked Paul.
It wasn't like he didn't know the background.
Mm-hmm. And so we learned that as well, right? That we can also be an encouragement to even non-believers because of our faith and dedication to God. And if you think about it, I was going to write this parallel, but I don't know if you see this parallel, that they were saved because of Paul's faithfulness and relationship with God, or else they would have perished. And many say, well, our nation, it is, and we're still hanging on because of believers who are still faithful to the Lord. And do we have faithful believers in America? I think we do. We have many. But I don't think we have as many as we think we have. Right? Some people say, oh, well, America is almost all Christian. I don't buy that. But I think it's hanging on that, right? Our hope is in God. And hanging that because of our faithfulness, God will spare us. Let's not count it as so, because remember, Rome was very wicked, and they actually pretty much eradicated all the believers, and some actually ended up leaving after 70 AD. They left Jerusalem, the ones that escaped, but a lot of them were killed. So let's not say that will happen to us in America. We may be spared, we may not, but it doesn't matter, right? Is the church still going, even after that? Did they eliminate the church? No. The church is still vibrant, still alive, and we have many who are still following him, and we need to realize that we have to be faithful to him no matter what.
I think our strengths will start showing now more, the strong point. So what we